Also, there might be greater expertise, perhaps the regional level, to manage valuable mineral resources. But it seems to me it does work a lot of mischief. In the land claims book, which I edited and wrote, I concluded, being a non-lawyer, we often conclude a lot of things, that even though the owner of the subsurface had the right to reach it, that the corporation, particularly in this unique situation, would have to respect the rights of the surface owner even more fully than conventional law would compel. So I hoped that sort of writing that down would help assure that village corporations asserted such rights. But I think it has been kind of mischievous, although the subsurface wealth has been far, far less than sort of believed at the time. I mean, I'm trying to think of any subsurface wealth that was undeveloped at the time of the Act that is now developed. Cook Inlet picked up a number of operating oil leases, but I mean, the efforts to find wealth in the gravel is it, I think, though, as far as the Settlement Act. But it's kind of a complicated web to untangle, it seems to me, as a matter of law and equity among your regional shareholders and the others. Kind of limited reflections on that issue.
I read that the record of that meeting that was held at Doyon, at which you spoke, and the lawyers then debated some of these propositions. And I read your book on land claims and the article you wrote about 3 years ago that had a provocative title, I just wondered if you had any at large observations to make on ANCSA and ELCA and the events of the last 12 years.
Well, let's see. I suppose my views are not much changed since that piece I wrote called Looking Beyond Capitalism. And I guess I show my own, going to a soft voice here, I show my own kind of non-materialist side in that piece, but I thought an important thing was happening in Alaska at that time, and because I think a sense of self and sense of community are of far greater importance than wealth, and so I was very impressed with that movement. The paper was very thin because my obligation had been to write 10 pages explaining the act, the consequences, the circumstances of natives today, and I don't know, four or five other things, so it was pretty thin. One thing that I paid inadequate attention to, I think, was this concern about corporate takeover in the future once stock is transferable, although ANILCA, as you know, of course, undertakes to address it. And preservation of land base. I was, I suppose, very much taken by this other concern at the time, even though 1991 wasn't that far away even then, 7 or 8 years away. And I knew it was being talked about. I ended up not making it a theme. I suppose the reason for greatest, I'm not sure whether my views are that important on this subject, but one of the things that I thought most dismaying is corporate behavior. I'm just an observer, I'm not a stockholder anywhere, that didn't respect the unique nature of the act. Because it seems to me the act itself was, whatever disagreements there might be about its particulars, was a moral decision by the Congress and by those who made it happen, and there are compromises involved, but it wasn't, well, as such, of course, persons became stockholders by virtue of ancestral claims. It seems to me this should have dictated certain kinds of corporate behavior, a very conservative corporate philosophy as far as spending. So I've shared the distress only in a philosophic way of those stockholders who have seen some of their wealth dissipated. And I kind of wished I had, you know, somewhere along the way suggested someone write about it, or maybe I'm wrong, but I mean, or write about it myself. Because no investment philosophy, of course, was embedded in the act, but certainly it was for long term. It just seems to me the fact that, and also the binding nature of the stockholders would suggest a conservative philosophy. If I'm a stockholder in your corporation and you want to acquire all kinds of high return, get into high return adventures of all kind, and I don't like it, I can sell my stock. I may lose a little on it, but I can move one way or another. People can rush in and they can say, oh, it's a high return man and we'll make a lot of money out of this. But when your stockholders are bound to you, they can't register that kinds of approval and disapproval except at annual elections.
They can't vote with their feet.
Right, right. So it seemed to me that, I don't know, there should have been more discussions about what is the appropriate investment or spending philosophy. But again, I'm just an observer, and it's one of the things that troubles me.
Well, I'm very grateful to you, Mr. Arnold, for coming down and keeping us informed of your views on these matters, not only the land banking, but all of these other things that we persuaded you to discuss. I'm sure that once you leave, I'll think of more questions, but...
I'll see you tomorrow.
Okay.
I only express the hope that my remarks were not presumptuous. One can't help thinking about the world around and end up having observations. Take them for what they're worth.
Thanks very much.
See you tomorrow.
Right.
My pleasure.
Well, it's been an interesting afternoon. It started out quietly and then picked up quite a lot of freight, so unless somebody wants to speak now, I think we'll adjourn until this evening.
I just yes. Have one.
Mr. Strong?
Well, Eugene, you
want to say? Well, no, I don't want to say too much. I did come from the chief's house in Sitka and lived with him. And
do you want to sit over here, sir? Well,
I'll take 5 minutes.
All right.
But I did get the reports from the historians and the observers when the sale of Alaska took place, you know, because I was one of those who were going through an apprenticeship to be a chief. And it's contrary to what has been going on since then, you know. It's really amazing what has been going on there. Now, when the chief of the Southeast turned over his power, so to speak, to the United States government, his intent was that they would teach us how to govern collective groups, because he said we only govern small groups. He did not intend in any way to turn the land or its minerals or the fish or anything over, as I understand. These things happen. It's surprising that when the observer who was an Indian was watching the negotiations over the so-called sale of Alaska, you know, when the Russians finally got the agreement they wanted, they turned around and told the United States government, this reach is all we own, with a few trading posts. For the rest of Alaska, you'll have to negotiate with the natives. But ever since then, the whole of Alaska has been claimed by a government. And I know they were asked, he was asked one time, why didn't you fight? He said, we just licked Russia, and now we have two governments standing on our land. How can we fight both? These are some things that I think we have a tendency to forget. And you're from Canada, I believe.
Yes, sir.
Well, we thank you for the land you gave us back to us. The During that time, it was a chief who went up to north of Tuckhorn, and he was amazed to find that the boundary line is something like 8 miles north of Tuckhorn. And he said, "This is all my land." And Canada said, "All right, we'll give it back to you." That's why it's up near 42 Mile now, actually. There's so many things that have been more or less hidden, seems to me. And yet now people who live there have land in London, and because of obedience to the chief, not the United States government, but to the chief of the Tlingit Nation, he told them to obey the United States government. They did go ahead and make their request for land allotments, even though they had lived and worked on that land. And some of them were turned off. It seemed like just a way to get them off of that land. They had it all this time. So these things kind of bother people, you know, and the intent of turning this governing over to the United States at that time was for protection and to learn how to get along with each other. And if the people would say, "Well, he was a poor Indian, didn't know any better," he did, because it was just a matter of a short time after President Lincoln freed the slaves that he in Alaska freed the slaves of here. So he understood what was going on. But I am glad to say now that it seems like the process of teaching us how to govern is now finally beginning to come, and it's really to the benefit of the Caucasians, actually. Because 9% of the people in North America and South America are Caucasians. And the process of education is taking hold among the people by Indians and other colors. It's just a matter of time. The equality would reverse the minorities. And I think it's to their benefit to cooperate with those who are considered minorities. There's much more to be said, but I do appreciate you coming and learning more.
Thank you, sir. Glad you did come.
I just had one thing, very important thing about the houses I forgot to, because I caught myself starting to go in a circle, is that the heating process, the heating systems in the houses was designed for the lower 48, because the heating ducts were from the ceiling to blow heat air down, where in Alaska it always should come from the floor to heat the air going up. And the secondary reason why they had it on the ceiling is because those houses down there would be able to be equipped with air conditioning. And that's where the air conditioning ducts would come from, is the ceiling, because the cold air comes down. But when they weren't made for Alaska, they were just made for the lower 48.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the big reasons why we have a lot of problems with the heating, because by nature of the way that it was constructed.
Well, thank you, and we'll adjourn until 7:30 tonight, and you're welcome to return at that time, and then we'll carry on tomorrow for as long as is necessary to enable any others to speak. It's been a good afternoon, and we'll see you tonight at 7:30.
Thank you.
Meetings in every region of Alaska to review the land claim settlement of 1971. And we've been holding meetings since mid-February, and we have set aside these 2 weeks for meetings here in Southeast Alaska. We had a meeting last night here in Juneau, our first, that went on till almost 11 o'clock, and we've been available here all day, and quite a few people have come in and spoken to the commission, and so we're glad you're here tonight, and I welcome you. The proceedings are being recorded by Jeff Berliner here, and everything that's said is taken down, because at the end of all these meetings, I expect to write a report, and I want it to be based on what Alaska Natives and Alaskans generally have said at these meetings. And so there will be a permanent record of all that is said, and that record will be available from the University of Alaska. The meetings that we've held in the West Coast, in the Otna region, in Fairbanks, in the interior, and now here each one is different from the others, but some basic themes seem to keep coming up. The land, subsistence, the family, 1991, native government, all of these questions. And I don't want to say any more than that about them now, because I'm really here to consider what you have to say. So if you feel that you'd like to say something, you don't have to have a great long prepared statement in writing, but just whatever thoughts are on your mind. If you wouldn't mind coming forward and being seated here so what you say can be recorded, that means we're open for business. This is Bill Hess of the Tundra Times, and Eileen McLean, who's also seated at this table here, is working with the commission and helping to organize these meetings. So we're here to give you an opportunity to say what you think about ANCSA. And yes, sir.
I'd like to say I belong to a group called the Native Group, willing all to thank you, Alaska.
Could you let me have your name, sir?
My name is Al Martin.
Would you mind sitting here so we could,
yes,
what you say could be recorded, Mr. Martin?
Originally, my grandparents came from Kenke, Alaska. And we were applied for township under the Settlement Act. And we were ruled ineligible. And after we were ruled ineligible, we formed a native group under the Articles of the Law of the Native Land Claim Implementation Act. And we held our first meeting here in Juneau. We have a headquarters here in Juneau. We hold, when I say we, I include my family, Mrs. Martin. We hold 100 shares in Sea Alaska Corporation. Yes. My question is, I understand, well, how are they going to treat the Native group in our situation? I understand we're the only particular group like that in southeastern Alaska. I understand there is a group similar to ours in the western Alaska. So, I don't know if we were treated fairly or not. This is my question. And to myself, I thought we were treated unfairly.
Well, we've mm-hmm. run into people in the interior of Alaska who mm-hmm. formed groups mm-hmm. where there weren't enough people to constitute a village corporation. They're allowed to form groups and incorporate in that way under the Act. But all that we've heard so far has indicates that all of these groups have taken years be certified under the Act. And has your group been certified under the Act, or is it still pending?
Yes, it's been. I believe we have a file, the whole complete file, under the criteria, number of people. We made the criteria. We have more than 25 people registered in Tenneke. But the question was that Tenneke wasn't recognized in any village at one time historically. Under that criteria, we were voted down. And we have the complete files on Tenneke. We try to correspond with the attorney from Sea Alaska. I forgot his name. So our files are open to your people if need to be examined. I reside here in Juneau. I live North Douglas Highway, and my telephone number is 907-586-3396. And my wife's work number is 586-2192.
John Martin left some papers with us today.
Oh, great.
He just left us the papers this morning, so I haven't had a chance to look at them, but that may cover a lot of the ground that you
Yes,
see.
We also have a duplicate file of that.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm glad you were able to let us have a copy then.
I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak on the behalf of our Native group.
Well,
if there are any questions, I'd be willing to answer them.
You ask whether your group had been treated fairly. I, of course, can't answer that, but did you say that your group had or had not been certified?
At the time.
We are not certified. We were denied.
I see. You were denied certification as a group?
Yes, as a group also. Denied at the village and then denied as a group several years later.
I follow you.
I believe at the time they were doing some research work. The archaeological people were doing some survey work around Tenneke, see if they had historical burial grounds effect, I guess, had something to do with the ruling also. And that's the reason I made that comments. Mm-hmm. And we weren't furnished with any information on the findings. We were totally kept in the dark. What we had to do was working through our own research.
Well, I of course cannot do anything about the refusal to certify the group, but it is useful to me, in conjunction with the other evidence I've heard about groups, to make an assessment of how well the Act has worked in relation to small groups. So I'm grateful to you for bringing the matter to my attention.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, any others who wish to discuss the ANCSA or their experience in relation to ANCSA or any of the other issues that have come up? Please do.
My name is Nellie Bennett, and I would just like to express my feelings as a shareholder and having watched our land claims come a reality. And maybe I could just read this how I feel. It's not, I wish I had more time, but it would express to you how I feel about it.
Certainly.
As the land claims became a reality, I was very proud. As the issue of the land claims became before the American public, it was with a sense of pride to be an Indian. I, however, disagree with the way our corporations operate by state laws. Being Indian, it should be run our way. Right now, what I'm trying to say is our corporations are organized in such a way it ties our hands. Take the election system on electing new board of directors. It is impossible to elect new officers unless you're very wealthy. Our own corporations can campaign for their choice of directors using large amounts of money for the cause. If electing boards of directors was done easier, we could most likely bring in new directors and work on problem areas. It appears to be our system of electing board of directors will destroy us. And I just want to say I feel very strong on that because I've worked on elections where you try to get in someone into the system of board of directors according to state law, and here your own corporation is putting in thousands and thousands of dollars, and it seemed like it's just defeating it, and you can't get into the problem areas you would like to. I've seen many good people not elected because of this. It just ties up our whole corporation. And I would just like to say that when I was a little girl, I can remember a lot of our people who are not proud to be an Indian. And I would like to say that, you know, with the land claims, it brought our pride back and it made us proud to be Indians. And perhaps we won't get much money, but it brought back our dignity. And wherever you go now, we're proud to be American Indians. And I'd just like to express my feelings on this. Is there any way that they could work on such problems like that?
Well, I'm to look into the way the corporations function, but the way in which their boards of directors are elected and re-elected is consistent with the way in which corporations function in America or anywhere else. Your point is that they should function in a way that is consistent with native traditions and ideas. A lot of other people have said that too, and now I've started to ask some of them, well, how do you how do you do that? But we'll keep working at that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
The Alaska Native Review Commission. My name is Joe Hotch. I am a Tlingit from Chilkat, a community called Tlukwan. Tlukwan interpreted in Tlingit means always a community. I am pleased in the purpose of the Alaska Native Review Commission's meetings in Southeast Alaska. I am equally pleased to testify on my concerns before this commission. Our communities and tribes have governed themselves since time immemorial. Prior to the visit of white men into our tribal territories, and we intend to exercise our tribal sovereignty upon our tribal lands and property of tribal members to protect and preserve our culture, tradition, self-government, and self-determination of our future as Tlingits of Chilkat area. Our land claims began in 1929 by the Alaska Native Brotherhood. We entered a new world without education or knowledge of white man's laws that they applied to us upon our lands and property, where we already had Tlingit laws in effect, laws that we today still possess, and state or federal laws cannot rule on our laws. Then we entered into the Tlingit and Haida land claims, as it is known, in 1956. The court ordered that the case should be heard in two parts. It was first to be decided if the Indians did, in fact, own the land in question by virtue of their Aboriginal use and occupancy. Then, if the question was answered in the affirmative, the court would decide how much money should be given the Indians as fair and just compensation for the lands. On October 7, 1958, the court answered the first question in favor of the Indians. The court declared that the land had been taken from the Indians by the United States government when it created the Glacier Bay National Monument, the Tongass National Forest, and the Metlakatla Reservation. Also, the court found the government guilty of failing to protect the rights of Indians from white settlers. The court ruled that Indian title survived to about 2.5 million acres of land, Chilkat, Taines, Skagway, and Yakutat lands. The court had to decide if the value was based on a fair market or on the amount of money the land was worth to the Indians. Also, the court had to decide whether to include the value of salmon fisheries. Not once did the 490-some page document mention our fisheries as part of our claimed settlement. Then came the Alaska Federation of Native Land Claims, into which our 2.6 million acres of land was incorporated, so that the southeastern villages and members can qualify for benefits from the Alaska Native Federation of Native Claims. This was without the consultation with Chilkat Tribe, whom was ruled by a circuit court hold entitled to the 2.6 million acres of land. I proceed my testimony with the foregoing to familiarize the commission of the past in relation to Chilkat Indian Village, its membership with the state and federal government. I wish to testify on our number one, tribal lands, 2.6 million acres, number two, on sovereignty, number three, on subsistence, number four, on education, number five, on Eagle Preserve, which involves native allotments, number six, the two claims, and number seven, on the U.S.-Russia treaty. Number one is tribal land. Chilkat tribe used and occupied land known as Area 6 under Clinton Haida land claims and survived Indian title to 2.6 million acres of land. Seasonal camps were in use in many places. Spring, summer, fall, and winter had special places for different use and occupancy for subsistence purposes. We presently look to our use and occupancy with much difficulty to the same area for provisions of subsistence. Number two, sovereignty. Local tribes elect tribal leaders, in turn electing one chief to exercise sovereignty over land and property of tribal members and control the entire area. The elected chief made sure that the entire tribe honored other communities' tribal chief and their respected sovereignty over their land and property. Sovereignty is not received from the state or federal governments, but from choice of tribal membership elected to our separate communities, choosing some form of sovereign government for our community and its tribal members. The state demands a waiver of our sovereign immunity before we receive any assistance for improving our community or receiving money for any type, receiving money of any type for community development. An attorney represented me on tribal land and fisheries and proved that we had fishing rights within our boundaries. He later became an attorney general for the state and was saying, we do not have these rights. Number three, subsistence. Subsistence is a vital part of our lives as it provides meat, fish, berries, and many other native foods that our bodies are accustomed to and need of for our bodily survival. And we share our subsistence foods with one another. Helping one another is natural and is not as difficult as a non-native help, where you have to qualify to receive assistance of one form or another. Number four, education. Education, when being introduced to the Chilkat Tlingit by an agent or representative of the federal government, the agent or representative was ringing a handbell, and our chief approached him and threw the bell into the Chilkat River and told him he did not want our children to be educated in white man's language because we would lose our language, culture, traditions, respect for our Tlingit people. After our chief threw away the bell three times, he finally said, I will permit non-native education, provided you will educate us forever. Our BIA school was built in 1902, and we maintain that the BIA will have to continue educating our children. We're losing our local schools. We lost Wrangell Institute, and Montechkin is near being lost. Number 5, Eagle Preserve. We were not protected by the Bureau of Indian Affairs of our rights to use and occupancy of our lands. An Eagle and Forest Preserve was established right over our lands that we use and occupy for subsistence purposes. The state divided our blankets of the area by saying about 60 or 70 allottees would receive their allotments within 7 to 14 days after the passage of Senate Bill 796. 2 years, 1 month later today, no Tlingit allotment is even approved. We have been forced into many areas we do not accept. Number 6, there are 2 land claims. There is a confusion on the Tlingit Naida land claims and the Alaska Federation of Natives claims. The state, cities, and non-natives are misconstruing the settlements of the 2 claims. There needs to be an education of the state, cities, and non-natives on the true status of our rights of our settlements. It is my understanding that the Alaska land claims will not add any new rights, and it did not say existing Indian rights will end. It did not say that. I also understand previous Indian rights is still intact for us. Our concern is fishing and hunting rights. If it were even mentioned in the claims, the Indians of the other states would have opposed because it would begin to affect other tribes of the southern states. Alaska land claims, as it affects us, our village corporation was set up as state business corporations, also the regional corporations, does not fully represent shareholders of our villages because we do not have representation from our little villages, which is causing loss of true village representation in protection of our internal tribal status of our community, lands, and property. Finally, the fact that there was no treaty between Alaska Natives and the United States is true. However, the treaty between the United States and Russia affirms that the natives of Alaska will be treated as any Aborigines of the United States, indicates the recognition of our rights as any Indian tribe of the United States. Also, the treaty between the Indians and the United States provides that any time a territory joins the Union, it will have an admission law in its constitution before becoming a state, which in Alaska's case is Article 12, Section 12 and 13 of its constitution. Mr. Chairman, I have testimonies relating to my concerns as they appear challenging to our Tlingit people from the state or its representatives and departments. I will present it to your commission as a part of my testimony, and I thank you for your kind attention and my appreciation for the privilege to be heard at this time. And that's what I gave you there. If you have any questions on anything there, I think I and try to answer some of them.
Well, I'll have to, I'd like to look through this and maybe ask you some questions about it, this is correspondence relating to the
that there is on the Eagle Preserve and the forest that was proposed to be set over our village land. And that was our opposition to that bill. That's our testimony against the bill.
I follow you. I see. Well, I shall read this over then, and thank you very much for your testimony tonight.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, any other presentations this evening? I did a lot of the talking this afternoon myself to get things started, but I don't feel like doing that again tonight.
I don't have any testimony to give, but I would like to ask a couple of questions, and then if there's anything you'd like me to say or comment on, I certainly would. Could you help me understand a bit, and I'm sure that some of the people here have heard this before, I was just wondering, what particular purposes will the information that you're collecting be put to? That would help me if I'm going to prepare any written comment for your use. Do you expect to look to affect federal legislation? What particularly are you hoping to accomplish through collecting the information?
Well, the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and the World Council of Indigenous People have asked me to hold these hearings and to collect the views of Alaskan Natives and generally of Alaskans regarding ANCSA, the 1991 issues, and Native self-government, to put it in a nutshell. My own view is that that entails going to every region and holding meetings, such as this one, and giving Alaska Natives, in particular, an opportunity to discuss their own experience with the land claims. To what extent has it benefited them? To what extent has it made a difference in their lives in the villages and in the urban centers? What's their assessment of it after 12 years? not only are we holding these meetings in the villages, but we've been holding from time to time public roundtable discussions in Anchorage, to which we've invited Native leaders in Alaska, corporate executives, people from the government, and Native leaders and constitutional experts from the Lower 48 and from other countries. The meetings will go on until the end of the year, and then I'll write a report which will be made public. Now, the report goes to the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and the World Council of Indigenous People, and it's up to them, in a sense, to decide what they're going to do with it. But I have no doubt that if they think the report is useful and important, that they will make it a basis for going to the state administration, the legislature, administration in Washington, D.C., Congress, and the United Nations, for that matter, because both of the sponsoring organizations are affiliated with the United Nations. In addition, their view is that the experience of Alaska Natives with, I have this habit of wanting to make sure everybody in the room hears me, so even though I'm only speaking to you, I want to make sure that I'll get the benefit of our dialogue. I think it's clear the Inuit Circumpolar Conference feels that it will be useful to Native people in other countries and their governments, because this settlement here in 1971 was a landmark in the modern era, and in other countries people want to know, well, how did it work out in Alaska? How did it come out? The village corporations, the regional corporations, the land, what's the outcome? And so far we've found, and everywhere we've gone, that there's concern about the land, about 1991. There are concerns about the way in which the corporations function, about their performance. So we're collecting those views, and I hope that my report will be a report of which Alaska Natives can say, yes, that's useful to us. That he's the only person who's been around, talked to everybody, got their testimony down in writing, and his report is clearly based on what we told him. And then it's up to Alaska Natives their leadership, the people in the administration, people in the state senate and house to and in the federal government to decide where to go from there. So that's the way I see it.
Mr. Chairman, do you want to deal at all with issues surrounding ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Act?
I'd be happy to hear about them. It keeps coming up because it was, in a sense, Chapter 2 in ANCSA.
Quite so. Well, I'm certainly not competent to match the eloquence of Mr. Hotch, who just spoke, but I'm Representative Peter Gall, and I represent some communities which are impacted by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and ANILCA. And those include Heidelberg, Cake, Craig, Kluwak, Kasan, Angoon, Haines, Klukwan, Yakutat. And from Heidelberg in particular, but throughout the region, there are some significant concerns in the Tongass National Forest. I suppose it's primarily specific to those communities which are in the Tongass National Forest, as to whether or not sections 804 and 805 and 810 of ANILCA, which among others deal with the issue of subsistence, are being implemented according to the intent of the law and sufficient to the needs of the people. In some communities where sovereignty is less an issue than in others, the impacting of subsistence opportunities is raising that issue anew. I shouldn't say anew, but is making it very important, because the people have experienced a situation wherein federal planning in the Tongass has not responded to subsistence needs. My particular problem is to develop a strong state position in support of subsistence needs, among other land use needs of Alaska residents and Native people particularly, but rural Alaskan people in Southeast, I think, as a whole, are to different degrees subsistence dependent. And the definition of subsistence, of course, differs somewhat with the individual, as well as whether you're speaking of it as a legal or as a practical matter. But throughout the Tongass Forest and in the communities which I represent, it's basic to the lifestyle of the citizens there to have an opportunity to harvest fish and game, forest resources of different types, in an environment which is stable, in an environment which assures availability of those resources. And that availability is limited both by federal activities in the Tongass National Forest with regard to resource development, and state policies with regard to legislation and regulation which govern how much fish, how much game a person is able to take. And of course, the resource development activities govern how much fish and game are available to be taken. In communities on Prince of Wales Island, for example, a person might be limited to 10 fish per year on a subsistence permit. Whereas in another community, let's say in Haines, a person might be limited to 25 sockeye per year plus other fish in varying numbers on a subsistence permit. The questions are, of course, whether or not the numbers are consistent with the need. And I think that's something that your group should address, should look at various communities' needs for subsistence resources and ensure that state law and federal policy provide for those needs. In section, I believe it's 804 of ANILCA, or 805, there is a requirement that the local fish and game advisory committees be consulted before any federal activity takes place in the Tongass National Forest, which could negatively impact subsistence resources. I chair the Southeast Advisory Group of the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas, and both of those groups passed resolutions directed to the Forest Service requesting that they implement those sections of ANILCA. The Forest Service responded that they do, but in querying the chairman of the various fish and game advisory committees, the fact remains that no contact is being made in any orderly fashion, certainly, from the Forest Service to the fish and game advisory committees to determine, in fact, how various kinds of development activities in the Tongass might affect subsistence, and the impacts have definitely occurred. There's no question in anyone's mind that damage has been done. Moving to the state, we find a real problem that needs resolution in determining how prioritization of uses will be ordered. One example, which I think is a good case in point, occurred down in Heidelberg in a place called Natsuni Bay, which is where the local residents are able, with small skiffs, to access crab for local harvest. When a larger vessel coming from another community comes in to attempt to capture crabs for commercial purposes, resource conflicts develop. It's still a weakness in terms of state policy and still a conflict throughout the state as to how these kinds of priorities are to be set. And right now we're protected with a subsistence priority, but at the same time the argument is raised as to what is a local resource and what is a state resource. So I think addressing the issue of local use of fish and game, although a difficult issue, is one that needs to be resolved. It is very closely related to the sovereignty issue in the sense that people who have lived traditionally in a community, and for that matter, local residents in general, feel that they not only have a right, but a basic need to have access to their local resources, because they may not and should not be forced to have the economic resources to go off to some area 200 miles away to satisfy what's always been available locally. So trying to resolve the state's interest and the legal matters with the needs of local communities for subsistence, I think, is basic to resolving some of the problems. But the only point that I would care to make and to bring to your attention, and naturally I'd answer any questions you have, would be that at this time the state is not taking a sufficiently aggressive attitude in relation to the federal government in ensuring that local citizens' needs are being met in the context of these federal pieces of legislation, which theoretically created the mechanism which would ensure that local subsistence needs would be met. And in fact, economic problems and power conflicts between different sorts of resource-using groups and political pressure applied more or less successfully, all of these things are very relevant to how decisions are made with regard to what subsistence resource will be protected to what degree. It seems to me there's a basic responsibility on the part of government to ensure that people who wish to live in Alaska or who have always lived in Alaska and wish to live close to the earth and harvest the natural resources for their personal use, those rights should be protected, and we do have laws in ANILCA which theoretically offer that protection. But I think one of the successes which you as an organizer might have would be to generate a sufficiently cohesive degree of public support for the enforcement of the federal legislation and a sufficient degree of support from the state to ensure that the people in Washington keep true to their trust. So it's not just a matter of directing energy to the federal government. It's also a matter of coalescing state support in support of the federal legislation. And because it becomes a matter of the state being an advocate on the federal level, it's a great deal more problematic than just simply getting the state itself to take a particular step. But that's equally necessary insofar as once the resource is protected, then the allocation issues begin, and that becomes a state matter. So in terms of ensuring that the subsistence resource continue to exist, I would like to see the state and the people involved put direct pressure on the federal government and then follow that up with direct pressure on the state government to ensure that the local subsistence needs retain the priority which they have today in state law. And if I didn't think there was a continuing